Bruchem Aboyim to the new series of lectures of HashkofaCircle.com on Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik of Yoshaber Soloveitchik's work, posthumously published work, The Emergence of Ethical Man, which is a work which was published in 2005, that's 7 years ago, and has up to heretofore received very little attention, both in academic circles and in other circles. But as we're going to present it, represents not only probably the most central work of the Rav's philosophical corpus, but could actually will turn out to be one of the central works of Jewish philosophy of the 20th century. Now, to give a little bit of background about the work, The Emergence of Ethical Man, and Ashkocha has it that I'm also part of the background too. Now, let me explain. Quite a number of years ago, I was given a manuscript by Robert Blau, a manuscript of lectures entitled Lectures on Genesis, Lectures on Bereshis, Shiurim on Bereshis, which the Rav of Yoshaber gave in the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University sometime in the late 40s. And I was commissioned to work on this work, to edit it, and to supply footnotes. The work, as of now, has not yet been published. A few years after that, I was presented with another manuscript, lecture notes of hundreds of pages, written by Rabbi Yaakov Hamnick, here of Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh. And the lecture notes were actually bought by the OU, who commissioned me to work on them, edit them, and to supply footnotes. Rabbi Ramnick had marked on his pages, on his manuscript, these were notes taken at lectures, the Yud Gimel Ikrim. But it was clear to me after the first lecture that either he had gotten the name wrong, or there was a mistake in the course name, or in fact that Rabbi Yoshaber had decided after the first, second lecture he was going to go on to something other than Yud Gimel Ikrim. For lack of a title, I entitled it A Philosophy of Judaism. The work actually is at the OU, and in Mirtz Hashem, B'mheira B'yameinu, will be published hopefully near future. What's interesting is that the philosophy, I'm going to call it the philosophy of Judaism, that's what I called it. I noticed that there were many sections of it which were almost word for word of the first half of The Emergence of Ethical Man. Evidently, these lectures, the Hamnick lectures, called the Hamnick lectures, were delivered either on the basis of which Rabbi Soloveitchik would, in fact, write the spiral notebooks which were found after his death, which were later published, entitled The Emergence of Ethical Man. Or in fact, it could possibly be that Rabbi Soloveitchik had written these notes previously to this. This is all conjecture. And his lectures were lectures on the basis of these notes. Now what's interesting is that the notes cover material in The Emergence of Ethical Man, the first part. That means the part of The Emergence of Ethical Man up till not including Avlad Bechlal, Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu are not in these notes. It's interesting, at the end of these notes, Rabbi Soloveitchik goes into a side topic, a more halachic topic, a standard shkafic topic, and evidently decided not to lecture on the second half of Emergence of Ethical Man, either maybe he had not written it down, etc., etc. I'm leaving this all for those of you who are amateur, professional, intellectual historians to actually, as topics of further research. Now, the fact is that these two lecture notes, I'm going to call them the Blau lecture notes and the Hamnik lecture notes. Hashgacha has it that they're actually related. How are they related? The lectures on Genesis, there Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about, actually his main topic is actually the creation of the world, Briyas HaOlam. The lecture notes really cover to a certain extent the first perek of the Chumash, the creation of the world. From there, he goes on from a much more rational understanding, we'll explain what this means a little bit later, to a Kabbalistic understanding. The lecture notes, the Kabbalah part, the Kabbalistic part, culminates in two lectures which give a description, a Kabbalistic description of the Shabbos. After that, there are two more chapters, chapters 12 and 13, which actually are word for word from the very first part of the emergence of ethical man. There, Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about man's, the naturalistic way of looking at man as opposed to Christian theology. He speaks about evolution, almost word for word to the first part of the emergence of ethical man. Now, Darsheni, what does this all mean? It might be that the Blau notes preceded the Hamnik notes. In other words, the Hamnik notes, the Blau notes, were lectures on Genesis. And then at the end of the lectures of Genesis, Rabbi Soloveitchik goes into a new topic, which constitutes a naturalistic picture of man and the creation of man and man's relationship to the world and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then the next semester, he continued on this thing. That's my conjecture. And he continued on this thing and basically finished off with the philosophy of Judaism, the Hamnik notes, the first part of the emergence of ethical man. So b'hashgacha, we actually can actually conjecture as to the origin, the intellectual origin of these concepts. In addition, what's interesting is that this actually, not only is there a conjectured historical progression, there's actually a thematic progression. And I'm going to actually present the thematic progression right now. I'm going to begin presenting it. Due to technical difficulties, we were a little bit late starting, but Baruch Hashem, we were able to overcome them. And we're going to continue this in Mir Tashem in the next lecture. And the thematic progression is extremely interesting. It's extremely interesting not only for the emergence of ethical man, it is also very interesting as to understand in a totality the thought of Rabban Shel Yisrael, Rabbi Yosha Ben Soloveitchik. And not only that, it's actually the basis upon which we can actually explore, in my opinion, in greater depth, a newer understanding of Jewish philosophy. Okay? And the Mir Tashem, we hope to be able to accomplish part of this in the upcoming series of lectures. Okay, now. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's Emergence of Ethical Man, we see a work which is in complete contradistinction to everything that he published in his lifetime, just about. Now, once again, there are many works of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I now want to focus on one of his most famous works, which is the Halachic Man. We'll get to Lonely Man of Faith a little bit later, maybe next time. But Halachic Man is important because Halachic Man, in fact, actually, the ideas of Halachic Man reverberate through many of his works and also really typify who Rabbi Soloveitchik was as, in fact, one of the premier and most notable and central halachic men of the 20th century. And for this, we're going to have to look a little bit of the philosophical backdrop in which Rabbi Soloveitchik writes. I want to quote from a hesped that Rabbi Shabel gave on his uncle, Yitzhak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik, the Bris Gerov. It's a hesped that I think is called Madoidi Midoid. It's published in Hebrew. I'm sure someone's translated. I want to quote what Rabbi Soloveitchik says to say about the Zayde, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and about the philosopher Immanuel Kant. This is my translation. Kant, in his day, declared the independence of pure reason of scientific mathematical cognition. Rav Chaim waged a war of independence for halachic reason and demanded its absolute autonomy. Psychological or sociological interpretations of halacha are dangerous for its various essence, just as empirical evidence undermines mathematical concepts. If the halacha is based on worldly agendas, it loses its objectivity and degenerates into subjectivity. These are the words of Rabbi Yashaber at a hesped on the Biskarov, which is, of course, not only a hesped on the Biskarov, it's actually a shield be'iyun on Teras Blisk. Now, so I want to now read several lines, a passage from Halachic Man. There, the Yashaber Soloveitchik, in describing the philosophy of halacha, which was embodied in the works and in the lives of his predecessors, of his forefathers. Here, in an interesting passage, he describes the halachic process in very, very Kantian terms. I'm quoting from page 19. When halachic man approaches reality, he comes with his Torah given to him at Sinai in hand. He orients himself to the world by means of fixed statutes and firm principles. An entire corpus of precepts and laws guides him along the path leading him to existence. Halachic man, well furnished with rules, judgments, and fundamental principles, draws near the world with an a priori relationship. In a certain sense, halachic man can be termed and described as the fusion of Kantian ontology with the Torah, with the methodology of the Torah of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Actually, this methodology of Reb Chaim actually goes back to the thinking of Reb Chaim Volozhiner in the Nefesh HaChaim Shal Dalet, but we'll have more to say about that at another time. Now, the affinity between the philosophy of Kant and the Torah of Reb Chaim actually plays a pivotal role in Rabbi Soloveitchik's life himself. As a doctoral student in philosophy, University of Berlin, Rabbi Soloveitchik's doctoral thesis, in fact, actually was written on Hermann Cohen, who Rabbi Soloveitchik, in the lectures on Genesis, calls the greatest modern Jewish philosopher. I'm going to quote now from the lectures of Genesis. He declares Hermann Cohen to be the greatest of Jewish philosophers. And it's in the lectures of Genesis, as I will actually speak about that a little bit later, the work is filled with Hermann Cohen's philosophy. Now, who is Hermann Cohen? So for this we have to go back. What was the role of Kant in the history of philosophy? We all know that philosophy reached the point, I think it was probably most expressed in the philosophy of David Hume, of skepticism. Skepticism meaning that philosophers became skeptical of the reality of what's called natural law, scientific law, inherent in nature. David Hume raised what philosophers regard to be very, very strong arguments, which placed doubt on the reality of a methodical scientific law inherent in nature. I mean, just because the cookie falls the first 10 times doesn't mean we can prove that it will fall the 11th time. And so the philosophy of science was mirrored, right, in trying to place science on any type of a philosophical basis. The person who came to the rescue, with quotation marks, was the philosopher Immanuel Kant, who was actually understood, actually I think this might have been his words himself, engineered what could be considered in philosophy and in the history of human thought a type of Copernican revolution. What Kant did was to show that in fact we needn't say that the laws of nature, that science is inherent in nature, in order for science to be based upon a rational and firm basis. But rather, the truth of science lies within the subject, within the mind of human being. And man's mind, the truth of science, is really the truth of the way man's mind orders the world. That was the philosophy of Kant. The reason I think it's referred to as a Copernican revolution is just that Copernicus, I understand, Kusha v'tevel spitzidai, is just like Copernicus, while affirming that the world, the earth, is not the center of the universe. But nonetheless, through man's mind, man, in fact, becomes the center of the universe in terms of his understanding of the world. So too, Kant did the same thing. This is actually, in a certain sense, the answer to the problem that Copernicus was for theology for hundreds of years. Right? If the earth is not the center of the universe, so man is insignificant. The answer is no. The fact that man can conceptualize and discover the center of the universe, that itself is the center of the universe. Okay, now, so this was the philosophy of Kant. So, by the way, very important to understand that Kant was not saying that everything is subjective. He wasn't saying that. I once read somewhere, I think maybe, maybe Diane Gruenfeld's books that said that one should, or maybe even quoting Shushafel Hirsch, that one could make a bracha on Kant, as if to say that Kant was placing science in a subjective realm and therefore this leaves room for belief in the Torah. I mean, whether he said it or he didn't say it, I don't know. But in my opinion, that's obviously a total misunderstanding of philosophy. Whoever said that didn't know anything about philosophy. Kant was not saying science is subjective. All Kant was saying is that the objectivity of science is not, ontologically, right, discovered in the world, but is basically the truth of the way man thinks. That's what Kant was saying. I think that should be pretty clear. I once saw someone write an article a number of years ago claiming that science is all relative and subjective because of Kuhn's famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and therefore you see that scientists are negeia. That's also comes from someone who either didn't read Kuhn or didn't understand Kuhn. You certainly didn't have Kuhn as a lecturer as I had him in Princeton when I went to undergraduate. That was the furthest thing from Kuhn's mind. In any case, let's proceed further. Okay, now, very good. So now Kant has established that the objectivity of science is in the observer, or in the subject. Very good. But that just begs the question. So what's the observed world? What did Kant mean? I mean, we can make hakiras here. Does he mean that man, right, in his mind, right, creates or man discovers scientific law, and then these scientific laws discover scientific law which now become, in a certain sense, embedded in the physical world? Or do we say the physical world, the objective world, the thing unto itself, is really opaque and it says resists any scientific description, and just that these things are just concepts of man's mind by which he can describe his own thoughts or his own accumulation of evidence? This became a very big debate in the centuries after Kant. Okay? A very, very definitive answer, unique answer, was given by Hermann Cohen, who was the leader of what's called the Neo-Kantian school at the University of Marburg in Germany, where Cohen spent most of his academic life as a professor. Cohen claimed, and I'm going to summarize him very succinctly, Cohen claimed that neither of these answers are sufficient. But basically, what Kant meant, that science is a methodology. Science is a methodology. Man, almost ex nihilo, creates theories to explain the world. By creating theories to explain the world, then now the world is perceived with a certain structure. And then he might demolish these theories and create new theories. So in other words, science is a certain type of like a eternal generation, an eternal process of scientific explanation. And that's what science is. It's not important what's in the world, what's not in the world. The major thing, the important thing is the process of scientific discovery and the way science evolves as explanations of the physical world. This is a non-ending process. In other words, Hermann Cohen basically made this into a process. Now, it's very interesting that in the lectures of Genesis, on Genesis, that's called the Blaus Notes, in fact, actually, it's filled with Hermann Cohen. First of all, Slavik speaks about science, methodology of science, as opposed to, in other words, explaining the Chumash. But Soloveitchik there says that we shouldn't use scientific theories to explain things in the Chumash. Because the Chumash, the Torah, is emes, is truth. Choyk v'lo yavor. But science always construes new realities which change, we're constant in flux. What we thought was the scientific truth of the Torah a few years ago, today, might prove to be false. This is maybe a little bit of a message for those keen people who can understand this, that, you know, waging your bet on the truth of the Torah because of scientific theory is, in fact, actually a very, very dangerous bet, and very, very risky. This is where Soloveitchik says. It's interesting that Soloveitchik goes on to develop this topic there, which is Genesis, but I'm not going to go into it right now, but you should know that the lecture of Genesis, at least the first part, is in fact filled with not only Kantian philosophy, but Hermann Cohenian, Neo-Kantian philosophy. Okay. Up till now, we have Kant, Neo-Kant, Hermann Cohen, Halachic man. This is the Rabbi Yeshaber Soloveitchik of Halachic man. And the Rabbi Yeshaber Soloveitchik of his Hesped of the Bizgarov, and on many of the other works which I'm not going to go into. It's filled with his other works. It seems that at some time in the towards the end of the 19th century, beginning the 20th century, around the time that Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, was a student in Berlin, there was a type of a reaction against these theories of rationalism. That basically, reality is determined by the thinking of man. Because however I want to interpret Kant, however I want to interpret Hermann Cohen, however I want to interpret Hermann Cohen, all of these are theories in which reality is located in man's mind, man's intellect. But what about the world? As a type of a backlash against this philosophy, I'm going to call it a philosophy of transcendence, we have a backlash of philosophies, which I'm going to use the language of the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, philosophies of immanence, which point to the fact, or point out the fact, that the truth of man, or the truth of the world, does not necessarily lie in man's intellect. but rather in man's physical and existential existence in the world. Now, among Jewish philosophers, the two most outstanding, two most outstanding in this time were actually Martin Buber, who, by the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes several times in Emergence of Ethical Man, and the German philosopher Franz Rosenzweig, who wrote a very famous book called The Star of Redemption. In fact, Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig are usually said to be what's called Jewish religious existentialists. They're not trying to call them Jewish religious Jewish existentialists. They're not, I wouldn't say that they're religious, in the Hamish sense. But there's some type of, I don't even want to call it Maida B'Mitzas, but there's a relation, they're trying to connect. There might be a belief in God. If it's Elokev, I'm not sure of that either. But there's a connection with existential philosophy and what they perceive to be, quote-unquote, the Jewish religion. That's what I'm calling them, Jewish religious existentialists, as opposed to religious Jewish existentialists. Jewish religious existentialists. Okay? Reminds me of a comment of Strauss. That's Hoidaz Baldin, that I think he said Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption is a philosophical book on Judaism, and the Maya Nevuchim is a Jewish book on philosophy. Very good, Leo. Okay. Now, Levinas is also a type of existential philosophy, but that's a different, more of an ethical philosophy, which I think is important, but I don't know if he's good or not. Now, however, there's another philosopher who actually was Jewish. I actually saw in a book that says to him he calls him a ex-Jewish philosopher. But I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story. And in my opinion, he is the philosopher, just as Kant and Hermann Cohen loom in the background of halachic man, this Jewish philosopher, he's Jewish, if that happens to be Jewish, looms in the background of the emergence of ethical man. And I'm going to reveal it right now for the first time on hashkafasekhel.com. His name is a French philosopher called Henri Bergson. Henri Bergson. Now, I just want to tell you a very interesting thing. I read this in several places. Those of you who have an internet, chas v'shalom, you can get this on Wikipedia. And
they
also,
they can't watch this year anyway.
What?
If they don't have an internet, they
anyway,
can't watch this year.
Anyway. Well, someone's going to download it, whatever. Now it comes close. But anyway, Bergson was never, had anything to do with being Jewish. Not because he was Jewish. In fact, actually, there's a rumor that he even converted to Catholicism, although that has not been corroborated, right? But then, when the Vichy government took over in France, Yimach Shemam, right before the war, they were rounding up the Jews. And Bergson, though, was a very famous philosopher, a very famous homme de belles lettres, member of the chair of the National Academy of Arts and Sciences in France, was orphaned. They said to him, you don't have to wrestle with the Jews, you can wrestle with the Goyim. In other words, you don't have to wrestle as a Jew. He offered to save him. And he decided to go and list himself as a Jew. Wait a minute. I think he died even online. In any case, that's the story of Henri Bergson. Interesting. Ma'aseh Kiddush Hashem, according to the Mekuyesef, the person. So he's Jewish. And anyway, whatever schus Henri Bergson had, it emerges, in my opinion, the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now, this is not only a conjecture, because it turns out there's also another work of Rabbi Soloveitchik, which, by the way, is not so neo-Kantian, which is called The Halachic Mind. Okay? Someone told me a few years ago that only Rav Soloveitchik is the only person in the world who can understand halachic mind. I beg to disagree. But I want to actually quote two passages from halachic mind concerning Bergson. One passage is from a footnote on page 69. There the Rav writes, and by the way, even though halachic mind originally was published in 48, I think the Rav asked it to have it republished, I think in 1980. Writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, we have shown above that the Bergsonian revolt against the tyranny of the mathematical science gained impetus with the vitalistic trends rampant since Darwin and Lamarck's evolutionism. One fact is nonetheless clear. The problem of the living gestalt is central in the sciences of life. Even the mechanists have to cope with the problem of the whole. Here, he's being meranes. He's alluding to the fact that Bergson is a revolt against the mathematical sciences, by which he describes the halacha in halachic man. And he says that we have to cope with this problem. It won't go away. Now, page 35, he writes in halachic mind, the humanist is concerned not only with the conceptual and universal, but with the concrete, particular and individual. By reducing spiritual reality to common denominators, we ipso facto empty it of its content. Bergson defined intuition as follows. By intuition is meant the kind of intellectual sympathy by which one places oneself with the object in order to coincide with what is unique in it and consequently inexpressible. The concept can never replace individualities, structures which elude conceptual abstraction. This is a critique being made by Rabban Shi Yisrael on Kantian philosophy, and he's invoking the name of Bergson. Okay. Where does Bergson fit in? What is the philosophy of Bergson? Since we had technical difficulties today, we're going to leave that for next week. From an undisclosed place in Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, Kol Tov, and we will continue with Mir Tashem with the next shiur on the emergence of ethical man.